And welcome back to Carnegie Mellon University's book podcast, highlight of my week, truly. And especially, you know, this week is a special one because we have one of our own on our podcast.
It's going to be very exciting. So this week we read To Be Marquette by Sharon Dilworth.
The one and the only.
A name that you guys... many of you probably know and is near and dear to your heart.
Hella familiar, dare we say.
I would say. So Sharon Dilworth is a creative writing professor here at CMU. She has so many amazing things. She has received an Iowa Award in short fiction, a Pushcart Prize in fiction.
Oh my gosh.
I know, she's stacked,
she's
genuinely.
She's a star.
I'm a star. Her.
Oh my gosh. Pearl shout out.
So basically she's all around awesome, and she wrote this awesome book, To Be Marquette, that we read for this week.
Yeah.
And we're just like super excited to talk about.
She's published actually like three collections of short stories, The Long White, Women Drinking Benedictine, and Two Sides, Three Rivers, and two novels, so Year of the Ginkgo and My Riviera. Super, super awesome. And so it's a real pleasure to be able to read something of hers and then have her on to discuss it. We're really excited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very lucky to be doing this and to be able to share it with you guys. So this is going to be amazing. I'm a suck up, so this is my second time reading it. Because Sharon gave me a copy, signed it, and I said, okay, I need to read this immediately.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say that the second time reading it only made it better. I'm a big fan. I mean, we'll get to our ratings and everything, but I really connected with the main character, Molly, and I think that we're gonna get a little synopsis from the woman herself. But yeah.
Who better to tell us what happens in this book than the woman who penned it?
Period.
It's like having Thomas Jefferson in the room with us while reading the Declaration of Independence, dare I say.
It's probably even better than that.
How about positively better? Do you want to be in a room with Thomas Jefferson? Probably
please
not.
Don't make me. Like, please no.
Yes, I just loved like the setting. Super into,
yep.
Like very vivid with the upper, takes place in the Upper Peninsula. Marquette is home of Northern Michigan University. Since we are just so jazzed and can't stop talking about it, why don't we just like freaking get right into it?
Yeah, I mean, let's go, guys.
Thank you so much for being here with us for our second episode.
We are so excited to have you here. We did a little introduction of you before you're actually here, but if you want to introduce yourself a little bit, that would be incredible.
Great. My name is Sharon Dilworth. I'm a fiction writer. I have 6 books published, and I work at Carnegie Mellon University.
Incredible. We're so excited to have you here.
Yes. And just for a little like icebreaker before we get into the nitty gritty, this week, like what have you been consuming? What's been on the docket? What have you been watching, reading?
All right, so I'm planning a course for next year called Adaptation. So I'm looking at books into film. So this week I read The End of the Affair by Graham Greene, and I'm gonna watch the movie tonight. But I also looked at Brokeback Mountain. Okay, that's going to be in the course. And so I'm kind of looking at books that were made into films. So first on the list is Normal People, because I like both the book and the television series.
Okay.
And then I'm thinking also about The Remains of the Day, which I think is a great translation. But I also want to look at Emma and Clueless as kind of a different kind of adaptation. Okay. So what I'm doing is doing a lot of reading and watching the films.
Well, that sounds amazing, and I want to take it.
I'm taking the class.
Yep.
So you won't be able to get rid of us.
I'm in a noir adaptations class.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so, like, this is, sounds like...
this is a little more open.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
Oh,
it
good.
Sounds amazing, especially because I love Emma.
She does.
I love Emma.
I know it for a fact.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I do love Emma. Any excuse to anything Emma-related, I will jump at. How about you, Sam?
I have been reading another book by a professor here. You might know her. We all might know her, Jane Bernstein.
Oh, wow.
I recently found one of her books, Bereft, which is just, I know, it's heavy, very heavy, but I talked to her about it and she was so excited that I was reading it. And it's incredible
so
far.
It's a great book.
It's
so, so impressive. So yeah, it's incredible. And then I also saw I'm Still Here, which is that movie that has a lot of nominations. It's this Portuguese movie about, about dictatorship and the government in other parts of the world. That the whole movie is in Portuguese. I was locked in. It was an interesting film. It wasn't what I was bargaining for Valentine's Day, but that is what I ended up watching.
Excellent.
Sign of the times.
I mean, yes, absolutely. And Hannah?
I watched first episode, season 3 of White Lotus.
Let's go.
Very exciting. Super excited for the rest of the series.
Is there a dead body in the first pit?
You know it. You know it, but you don't... Yeah, but it's like the same. You don't know who it is.
Right.
But it's in...
I think that's a great... Oh, and it's, narrative thread.
It's so good, and it's so different each season. Like, this season is so different from the last two. They're in Thailand.
Oh, wow.
So it's, like, rocking so far. I'm super excited to get more into it, especially because one of the actors is the guy who plays Lucius Malfoy.
Oh, okay.
So, obsessed with that. He's also in, like, Hook. So, which was all a childhood
crazy.
He is. He's Jackson Brody. He's a detective by Kate Atkinson. Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so I've been doing that, and I read this. I read To Be Marquette.
Wow. I read that too.
Oh, that's so good. And I read Notes from Underground.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You guys are amazing.
Yeah, we got a lot.
We heart consuming media.
Yes, so. We do. We do love it.
Put it on a shirt. So just jumping right into it, we were wondering what inspired you to write this book, which is kind of a basic question, but I need to know.
Okay.
So a couple of years ago, my daughter was talking about, she's really worried about the climate and the world. And she was saying what should we do? And she was protesting, and she was a member of Friends of the Waterfront, of the Riverfront. And she was just like, how can we stop? Like, nobody is doing anything. And, straws, and she does, she recycled everything, and she composted everything. And she was like, why did you guys give us this world like this? So I started to think about back when I was young, and the stuff about Project Elf is probably the first time I ever protested. So I went to college, and there was this big controversy about Project ELF, which is the extremely low frequencies. It was a government-funded program that was going to be set up in Michigan's Upper Peninsula to communicate with submarines all over the world. And there was a big controversy because would it ruin Michigan's Upper Peninsula is a beautiful wilderness. And they were worried that it was going to ruin the wilderness. Like, it would ruin the animals, it would ruin the bedrock. So there were these protests against it. And as I learned more about it, I started to protest it also. So those were like my first time protesting climate and the world. And so then that's actually what got me started thinking about it.
Incredible.
Very cool.
I mean, would you want to give like a super short synopsis of the book for people that might not have...
Sure. So it's about a young girl from suburban Detroit who goes up to Northern Michigan University in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and starts to attend college. And it's a whole different environment for her. She gets involved with a group of ecology students. And basically, that's the premise. And there are all these things that go on with the climate change and the world, and she starts to get involved with all of them.
Beautiful.
Rockin'.
I love it. I mean, for the writing of this book, could you tell us a little bit about your process?
Sure. I mean, it's such a mess. I mean, like, my process is a total mess. I don't know if that's different. I mean, I would say most writers, like when you read a novel, you think, oh yeah, you just start at page one. Actually, I just read Anne Tyler does that. And I'm like, she starts at page one and finishes.
Wow.
So I can't, I mean, this is so, so different. I mean, I'm a mess. I just write like scenes and then I put them together. So like the first scene was really when the narrator is in the ecology class and they're talking about, the teacher says something about, sometimes people get excited when they hear of a huge disaster, and so many people die because so many people are worried about overpopulation, and the narrator feels some kinship with that statement because she's like, oh, I do that too, and then so that's like the first scene I wrote, which is not in the beginning, and it's just like she feels a kinship with her professor, and that he seems to understand her. So that was my first scene that I wrote. But you can see it's not the first scene in the book. Yes. It's like buried in there someplace.
Such a good scene, though. I was just thinking about that.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, it's interesting. And then I started writing like some of the present scenes also. So it's like, and then I just kind of string it together much, much later. But I have a lot of things I throw out.
How did the writing process for this book differ from your other published works?
I would say this one is probably a little more autobiographical than anything I've written before. Mm-hmm. I, like Molly, grew up in suburban Detroit. Yes. And went to Northern Michigan, mm-hmm. which were in Michigan, Northern Michigan and Marquette were huge impacts on me as a person. Yeah. It was just so different than what I knew. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really important to me, and it still is. So this is like my literary landscape.
Yeah. I when I was reading the novel, I was really interested in the dynamic of Molly and her theology students. They call themselves the Crusoes, which
doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't, but it works so well with right. him being Dr. Robinson, Robinson Crusoe. Like, it just worked very well. I really enjoyed, like, I don't know. I really liked that. But I was also just like super, I don't know. I connected with their dynamic, I guess, primarily just as someone who, like, in high school, I had a lot of like guy friends, I guess, as like the one girl as a part of a group. So I was just really interested in that. And I was sort of that character dynamic. I was just sort of interested how you like cultivated that, sort of like the inspiration, how that.
So, I mean, I definitely knew a group of guys. They were not called the Crusoes, but I used to think of them as the Nature Boys because uh-huh. they wore like flannel shirts. They wore a lot of leather wristbands. And I remember the first time they were in my ecology class. We all had to take ecology, which was really great.
Because what did you major, if you don't mind me asking?
I majored in French. Another whole story.
Oh, wow. Crazy. That rocks. I'm so sorry.
I'll tell you the evolution of that. Yeah. Okay, so I was at, so we had to take ecology, and what was great about taking ecology at Northern Michigan was because we walked in the woods, the first semester we had to take snowshoeing we could walk in the woods in the winter. So I loved that. Yeah. So in the ecology class, there were all these guys in the class called, I used to call them the Nature Boys. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time someone said, okay, we're going to go out and see these guys. They've been camping in the woods. And it was winter. Okay, and I just cannot believe that people camped in the winter. And we went, like, we walked into the woods and found them. And they'd been spending the night there. And it was just so strange to me. So I had this, like, adoration and admiration for them.
Yeah.
And actually, some of them are still my friends.
That's it's just so cool. It's also my stepdad's from Michigan, and he is a big camping person. And it is really like the knowledge that you get from being in that sort of like wilderness is just like really impactful, it seems.
It is huge. Yeah. It's huge. Yeah.
It's just like so sprawling.
Right. And I think it does make a kinship between people.
Yeah.
Like if you survive out there. Yeah.
And I can totally see like how well you know the environment from the way that you write about it. Because even before you got on, we were talking like, are you from this specific place? Because we were like, you seem to know it so well.
I wish I was from there because then I would have more reason to go back. And it's just so far away. But I was there this summer, and it was amazing.
I'm sure it's so beautiful.
I need to go. Yeah, we're going. Yeah, girls trip.
Yeah.
I also had a question about there's so many male and female characters in this book that reference the key difference between men and women a few times. It's brought up, and one of the key differences that's stated is that, like, women don't find the Three Stooges funny
true.
While men do, which is true. Which is hilarious, I thought. But I also...
If that's still a cultural touch.
Connected to me.
Oh, okay. Definitely.
Definitely. Yeah. But I wanted to ask, like, according to this book, what should we be taking away? What is the key difference between men and women?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the Three Stooges does hold up.
Yeah.
If people know who the Three Stooges are, okay. There's a huge difference between men and women. Either women hate them and men love them. Yeah. So that was something I always remembered. I think one of the examples that I give is Molly goes to a bar, remember the scene when they go to the bar, and in the corner is a woman stripping, and she goes over to the woman and says, like, you don't have to do that, it's just me and my friends. And the woman, like, really pushes her away.
Yeah.
So she remembers going to a strip bar in Canada, and it was a female strip bar, meaning that it was, like, female patrons.
Right.
And the men were not so much strippers as they were storytellers. And there was a lap dance, and instead of, I don't know, being sexy or something, the guy tells her how beautiful she is. Mm-hmm. And that really, I think in certain ways, just desires are different. Yeah. And what people want is really, really different. So I was trying to go along with that. So, and I really wanted to concentrate on Molly's desire, because she is sexual. She wants sex. Mm-hmm. And that's her dilemma. She wants to save the planet and she wants sex. So she's like all mixed up. And she doesn't realize she can have both. And I'm not sure she can have both, because I don't think she saved the planet. But but she did have sex. So so I think that's like, so she's confused about her desires. And the guys seem to express them so easily. And she struggles with that. So maybe at this age, at 18, 19, women have a little harder time expressing their complex desires, but I'm not sure.
Wow. Yeah, and I feel like that sort of dichotomy is reflected not just in sort of like the sexual promiscuity that we see and like the sex work that we see with the strippers, but also just in like the activities that we see. So like the euchre, how like all of the female students play that, and how like even Molly is sort of like bored by it. Mm-hmm. But there's like one point where Shane and John and all the guys are talking about it, and they sort of like make fun of them, but then they double back and say, we're not smart enough for those games. And so I thought that it was just, I made a note of that, because I thought that sort of, yeah, that dichotomy is like very much throughout the novel, that in pretty substantial ways that I was very interested in.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems strange now. I mean, obviously times have changed, but back then we used to have professors who only addressed the men in the class. He would say gentlemen, and just kind of ignore the women in the class, because they didn't really want to teach women. You know, so, I mean, there were not, it was a state school even, so yeah. it was just a little different time.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that the way that you kind of display that, because the two professors, there's a female French professor as well as Dr. Robinson, who's male, and they're both kind of dismissive and accusatory of Molly in different ways.
Exactly, yeah.
And I if you want to talk about that a little bit, I was so interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Robinson, he likes Molly, I mean, but he's got his own concerns.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's so concerned with his own stuff that he just kind of treats them all like he wants them to be stewards of the earth, but he's not so enthusiastic about that as much as he is trying to solve his own problems. And Madame thinks that Molly has a crush on Dr. Robinson and only treats her like that. Like, I'm so sorry you're in love with him, and you know you shouldn't be. Other women were in love with him, and Molly's not in love with him. She likes him, but she's not in love with him.
Right.
And she acknowledges that. Yeah. But Madame Graves can't get over that.
Right.
I know, and it's like she definitely like pedestalizes Dr. Robinson.
Oh, absolutely.
And like sort of like to be worshipped is not to be loved, you know, like that is not what's going on here. And
right.
It feels so apparent to like me reading it. You just like feel that frustration,
right? And so like the guys all adore Dr. Robinson, and that's fine, but Molly does, and that's not fine.
No, exactly.
And
I
that's
that
the
almost exactly right.
Yeah,
down. Yeah,
that's the delineation. Yeah,
yeah. And it's just like she's always walking this fine line that just feels so precarious. Like I even noted, like even like in being a sexual being, like I was a prick tease, then a slut. I was doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, just like, how real is that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. For every single like woman, no matter what context, it's just like, there's such a fine line for what you can and can't do to be perceived one way or another. And even like nowadays, beyond sexual things and like saying the right thing to the right person,
exactly,
not being misunderstood. And it's like, at what point are you not like pandering to that?
Right.
Sorry, not to get like preachy, but it's
no,
like,
go for
I really
it.
Like,
go there.
I was getting so frustrated by her being misunderstood that I was just like, God, I was like,
well, and she's misunderstood by her roommate,
Janet.
which
talk about Janet.
Yeah. So, which I think is like, especially teaching freshmen at Carnegie Mellon, I would say the first,
yes.
If I teach
yes.
freshmen fall semester, it's not their fault. All they ever talk about is their roommate. Because I think it's really hard to live with a new person.
Absolutely.
You know, someone who's not your family. And I respect that. And I listen to their struggles and I'm like, I don't have any advice. Like, you just got to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what Molly had to do with Janet. Like, she was a pill.
Yeah.
She was a real pill. And I mean, she calls her a slut for having someone there, which just seems like the most natural thing in the world.
I know. All clothes on, just on the bed.
Yeah.
There's not that many places to sit.
No, and so...
is that, like, when you come to college, there's always the one person that you hear about. Like, I thankfully had a great freshman roommate, and I was the one who had the great freshman roommate.
Right. I mean, that's rare. Yeah.
I feel like everyone else was like, this is happening. What the hell am I supposed to do? And right. I was like... Andrew and I sort of got it like locked down.
Then that was definitely strange. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, and I knew then that I was on the outside.
Right.
Because I, you know, even my sister, she's a freshman now, and she was going, and I remember she got her roommate assignment and they were talking about like what they like, and it was just like so polar opposites that I was just like, damn, that sucks.
It's a small space and people are on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And Janet is confiding in Molly, like tells her things like her father burned her house down.
So wanted to ask about that. Please, could you like talk about that a little bit, because I want to know what to take away from that.
So I think what I hoped is that Molly thinks they're getting close because Janet's confiding in her.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they're kind of telling secrets in the dark. But Janet isn't nice to her.
No.
So why is she confiding in her? You know, and she can't figure out, like, you know, are we close? Are we not close? You know, and she even asks her to go for a walk the first night. And Janet's a pill about the whole thing. Like, I don't want to do this. And Molly can't, like, it's the first night of, like, they're just up there for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, why not go for an hour walk? Like, what's the difference? But Janet can't do it. And yet Janet tells her things, you know, like she's in love with Jane and they don't get any closer.
Right.
So that Molly's like, how do I get along with this person who at one point is confiding a huge secret in me, and the next calls me a slut because I have a friend spend the night.
Right.
You know. So, and I think that's what sometimes roommates are.
Yeah.
You know so much about their lives,
mm-hmm.
but you don't really like them or you don't really know them.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
And you see them like 4 years later, and you're like, well, who?
I know. Mm-hmm. No, that's so great. It is. No, that is.
Yeah.
Really, like...
They used to do something at Carnegie Mellon. I don't know if they still do it, but during freshman orientation, they took them on the boat called?
Like the
Jolly Roger.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, no.
Like on the river.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a party boat, and they would go with all the freshmen.
Oh, if only they did that. Yeah.
And then they did it senior week. You would go back on the Jolly Roger and you would find the person you either were a roommate with freshman year or you went on the boat with.
Wow. You know,
and like what had changed in 4 years.
Wow.
I wish we did that.
Because
our freshman year, at least in Dietrich, I knew that because I knew because I was there with a bunch of, I think even like Connie was the one who gave me the merch because I, with Kim, my like friend from freshman year, and this other guy, we went to the Heinz Museum because
yep.
you all go
sure,
on
sure.
the museum day.
Yeah.
And the three of us were left. All of the buses had left and we were the only ones there and had to wait like an extra half hour for a bus to come around.
So
and it would be so fun
later.
To
yeah.
do that. I would love to reconnect with those people.
Yeah. Okay, we'll make a petition.
Because I thought that was so interesting because the people you hang with freshman year, your first year, you may not ever see again.
Changes drastically.
Mm-hmm. And it is an effort to keep in touch with those with those individuals just because of how life changes. So crazy. It is really so crazy how, like, how even, like, throughout this novel for Molly, like, how she begins versus how, even, like, when she's living in Marquette in the future,
mm-hmm.
like... how that changes. And I guess I just wanted to sort of get into what I was most curious about with the people that she meets besides Janet, Shane and Finley.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
Finley
mm-hmm.
in particular, sort of as, so like Shane, just for reference, is one of the Crusoes who is the pretty boy, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and is good with the ladies.
That's
and
Shane.
Shane. And Finley is his roommate.
Mm-hmm.
And Finley sort of covers for Shane when Shane's sleeping with Dr. Robinson's wife, and I was just sort of interested in how Finley came to be as a character, and like how, like with this sort of open ending, what were you thinking there?
Okay, so let me go back. So I think like we were talking about like as a freshman, you know, what do you do? And it is a really strange time in one's life.
Yeah.
Because no other time do you just go to a place without knowing anybody. I mean, you sort of have a job, but it's this strange, like usually if you move someplace, you're moving with your family or you're moving with, you know, your husband or wife or, you know, your kids. But when you're a freshman, you're just alone.
Yeah.
And so I think this search for finding who you are and where your place is, and in Molly's case, her purpose, because she doesn't really know why she's in college. She's not sure what she wants to do. She's just in college and she doesn't know anybody, you know, and there's no place to be.
Yeah.
Like there's no place to hang out or to go. And she knows the guys in her class and she wants them. And Finley is nice to her.
Yeah.
So that's why she kind of connects with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he tells her about Project Alf and kind of explains it to her. And he takes her around and is kind of nice to her.
Yeah.
So she thinks they're much closer, again, than they probably are, because he's got this huge secret.
Yeah.
And he can't tell her that. So he makes, like, they go out to Mrs. Robinson's house and he can't tell her why they're there.
Yeah.
And he lies to her. And she knows he's lying.
Yeah.
And then he tells her another lie. Then he tells her another lie. And then the whole thing about the government comes in, and she thinks that's all government secrets, but it's really not.
Yeah.
It's just that he's covering for Shane.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, who do you trust? Who do you belong to? Where do you go? What's your purpose? Is really Molly's confusion throughout the whole novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, speaking on that, for the elf, entire, like, elf storyline, I mean, going back and forth on who I trust as a reader, I was confused at some points, which I think was the purpose, but I didn't know who to trust Finley. I was in the perspective of Molly, and I didn't know what was happening. So would you be able to tell me a little bit about, like, what is happening with the elf storyline, and
right,
who should I trust?
So
Project Elf confused a lot of people because no one really knew what it was.
Right.
So the Upper Peninsula at the time was the most economically depressed part of the state. They're just, I mean, the copper mines closed, the iron ore mines were closing, so there weren't a lot of jobs. So people were unemployed. So if something comes in and says, hey, we're going to do this, it's going to bring jobs, you want to believe that, and you want to believe that it'll be like an economic miracle. But in fact, it was a government project. No one except the government was ever going to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And once they installed it, which had to be done by the government workers, no one from the area was going to work on it.
Wow.
And so it was kind of like a one and done. So that was a big cover up. And then it was never sure like where it was going to go. And I don't think people understood it. I didn't even understand it. I thought they were communicating, like, with the submarines in Lake Superior. Because you see this vast lake,
yeah,
and they're going to put underground, you know, systems in. You think that they're going to communicate. You think there are submarines there.
Right.
And there was a huge Air Force base about 20 miles outside of town.
Mm.
And those the aircrafts would break the sound barrier. So, like, there was always a little bit of, like, government army, Air Force over the whole area.
Okay.
So I don't think people understood what it was. So you're either for or against it without quite understanding what it was.
Okay.
And which is kind of like what the mystery is. Like, who do you trust? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing?
Right.
Do we need it? And remember, we were coming to the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was more of a 1950s Cold War investment.
Yeah.
And it just kind of petered out.
Right.
So, it was end of 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
We were definitely coming to the end of the Cold War.
I see.
Yeah.
And there were so many, like, newspaper inserts kind of throughout the novel that I found really interesting and, like, kind of broke up the story a little bit that I really liked. I wanted to know your process.
Okay, so I wrote those. Those
yeah.
are made up, and they're signed by my college friends.
Oh, really?
I know. I gave them all, like signatures. I don't know what they think about it, because I don't know if they read the book. But, like, Patty Gallivan, Bob Kershane, Eric Kramer, Donnie Kukla, they all got them. And they were, like, my friends in college.
That is so isn't that awesome. Funny?
As if they had written them. Like, they were protest levels letters.
I also just feel like the confusion of, you know, what am I, is the government telling me the truth about this environmental project or just any project of being implemented, I feel like is very, that confusion, and especially for people in college, right, like, we're our contribution to society right now is, like, being a full-time student, whatever that means.
Right, right.
You know, but it's, like, I am in a bubble, and I feel like that's a conversation to be had here at Carnegie Mellon, where we're, like, sort of shut off from the world in a lot of respects. I don't super know what's going on sometimes, mm-hmm. whether that's my own fault of ignorance or, like, the accessibility here. But I feel like even apart from that, this whole environmental, like, ELF being such a point of confusion for this community is very real.
Right. And remember, it's coming on a historical context. You had the Vietnam War, where the protests did matter. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like what I grew up with and thinking, like, oh, my God, those people really made a change. And then you're coming right off of Watergate, you know, where the government was corrupt and admittedly, and then it went down. Mm-hmm. So these are like, do you trust the government now?
Yeah.
And when they're saying they're going to bring jobs in, they might be the only game in town.
Right.
Yeah. You need employment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it just connects also so well with, like, the entire plot line of Molly's story of, like, she's confused and she's trying to do what's best and she wants to make a difference in her own personal life and for this, but she's just almost, like, going about it in the wrong way in certain times and, like, is confused. So I think that
it definitely connects. I was trying to mirror that.
Oh, yeah, you definitely did.
Did you ever, I'm so sorry,
no,
did
please.
You ever when, like, I know it was, like, a while back now, but, like, when, do you ever remember, like, wanting to write about Marquette while being there?
No.
Were you, like, one day I want to write about this?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Really? Absolutely not. Okay. Mm,
very interesting.
No, I had to be away from it to write about it. To go back. Especially, I didn't want to go there when I was writing the book. Because I didn't want to change what I thought in my head, because I created my whole world mm-hmm. in my head. So I didn't want to go there when I was writing it. I could only go after I finished the book. Because things have changed or, you know.
Yeah.
But in my head, I knew exactly what it looked like, and I didn't want to ruin any of that.
And I feel like that idea is central to, like, the image that you're able to paint here. And so I guess I'm just, like, going back to sort of, like, your process. Like, a day in your life of, like, writing, not just this book, for, like, any work that you do, like, what does it look like? Like, do you get up, like, are you like, okay, this scene is in my head, I want to write it down? Like, what is that process,
yeah,
that routine?
That.
Again, it's probably the messiest process in the world. Mm-hmm. I have notebooks all over my desk, and I just write down, usually I start with a character or some kind of scene,
okay.
and then I write that out. I don't know where it's going, mm-hmm. And I come back to a lot of things.
Okay.
So I take a lot of notes and come back.
And how long have you been, how long did you work on this?
It took me about 4 years.
Wow.
Because I threw out a lot. Mm-hmm. There were other plots and trying to put it all together. 3 years, yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah, wow.
Can I ask, I've taken writing classes with you before, so, like, do you preach what you write? Like, I mean, are you teaching it in the same way that you write your novels?
You tell me. I mean, I think you do one scene at a time, right? I think scene is the most important thing.
Yeah. I mean,
if you can get a scene down, you can start to get your story written.
I mean, like thinking about it as a scene too.
Absolutely. And it's working. I can't say it didn't work. Absolutely. So
no.
I think that whatever you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you took screenwriting with me, so you know we did scenes.
Yeah. And so it all builds on each other. I think it works.
Yeah. It's just so vivid.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I really loved, especially, like, opening it up. Yeah. Like, especially at the beginning, just, like, hearing all about the different sorts of foliage, the different pine, I was like, yes. Like,
yes.
I really do, it just paints such a vivid picture, which makes sense when I'm hearing that, like, right, like, Sam took your screenwriting class, where, like, in screenwriting, things are, right, it's a scene, it's so visual, like, it's going to be in front of you, you're gonna see it happen. And I really felt like I was watching it happen. I had an idea of what all of these characters looked like, and especially, like, the Crusoes, the sort of, like, long-haired nature boys.
I could see them.
Which is very much, like, I'm from Connecticut, and, like, we live in the woods, at least, like, where I am, and, like, that, when I wear, like, a flannel and a hoodie with, like,
you
my shoes, I, no, but I'm like, I feel like a guy from back home. I do.
Yeah.
I feel like any, like, guy who went to my high school. And so I was just sort of like, oh my gosh, like, this group is probably, like, I wish that I had been able to read this in high school. I wrote it down on a page. I was like, I should have read. If, like, senior year me could have read this, she would have been like, Oh,
that's it.
Wow.
Yeah. Another answer to your question is, you know, we talk a lot in especially in screenwriting, like, can we write dystopian, you know, screenplays?
Yeah.
Can we write dystopian novels? Or, and my yes, you can, obviously.
She knows I love dystopian.
Right. But I always say dystopia doesn't always give you the world you want to build in.
Sure, it's really hard.
Yeah, because the government is always corrupt.
Yeah.
Mm. Human life doesn't matter that much. Mm. You know, it's always dire. So sometimes if you set it in a different place, you would have more world building than dystopia. Yeah. That's my only comment about dystopia.
Completely fair.
Yeah, speak on it. Yeah. I agree. I mean, like, I don't do a lot of, like, creative stuff. That's where Sam supersedes me. But it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because it doesn't always provide enough. In my opinion.
It's,
so the students are like, and the government's corrupt. And I'm like, yeah, of course it is.
But then you have to create like 50 years prior of like why, and it's hard.
Or if it would be less cliche if the government was good.
True.
In a dystopian novel.
We'll work on that next time.
Could you?
Absolutely.
Wait, that's so awesome.
I love
it. Yeah.
Okay, I have another question about Molly that I'm dying to know. So my question is, does Molly care about love? Like, at all? Because the question is, she cares about sex and she wants to be desired, but I haven't throughout the book found a lot of her being like wanting an actual love.
I don't think she's there yet.
Yeah.
I think she does have this desire, which surprises her. She's without authority, so she can kind of act on that. Because there's a remembrance of having sex when she was in high school, and they were kind of hiding all the time.
Which I loved that chapter, by the way. That was great.
And so now she's without authority, so she is desirous. So I don't think she does have love yet. I don't think that's where she is. I understand the question, but I don't think she's there.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think that's real.
Yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't fall in, and then she even says, if any of them desired her, she would desire them back, I think I said.
Literally, the page where I wrote down, wish I had read this in high school, underlined is, to be one of them, to be with one of them. If they wanted me, I would want them back. Literally what I have open.
In my head, I was just like, oh yeah, she does sex with
No.
Yeah.
And also, like, there is, like, it's a real thing. I mean, for some people, I mean, Sam has been in a relationship since freshman year of college, so this is not applied to Sam.
Did you fall in love? I guess you can't, I mean.
Very quickly.
Hey, this is our
podcast. Shout out Regina. She's going to be listening. Absolutely. That's my wife. Yeah. Very quickly.
But I mean, right. But
were you looking for love?
I would say so. I was.
Yeah.
And I sought her out.
Which is like so, like, me came to college, I was like, I'm not going to be in a relationship, like, my freshman year, like, I don't know, like, what I'm doing, to then put that on another person would be, like, insane. Yeah. But one of my boyfriend now, we've been friends with since freshman year. So it's like, I fully knew who he was. I was just, like, so emotionally unavailable. And I knew that, which I feel like her and the way that she talks about things sort of in this very casual way is so real. Like, you don't want to get attached to that when you're like trying to figure out whether or not you care about like saving the world in
nature,
like a real way.
Yeah.
Like the whole dichotomy of like, do I want to save the world? Do I want to have sex? Right. Do I want to do this?
And what I think
like, the surprise is, I'll get back to your love question, is that she falls in love with Marquette. So she falls in love with the place.
She absolutely does.
Real.
Yeah. And we even see her like in the future like everybody else has left and she can't even wrap her head around why everyone else has left because to her it's the most beautiful thing in the world,
right? So she doesn't want to leave,
right?
So she found love in that respect.
I feel like that's how you talk about Pittsburgh, Sam.
I love Pittsburgh.
I do too.
I love it. I know we've bonded over this. It's honestly
too.
It's too good. Anyways,
I have a question.
Go ahead.
How have your experiences with, like, I know we talked about how, like, talking to freshmen about roommates is funny, but, like, how have your experiences with students at Carnegie Mellon sort of helped you paint this picture of Marquette? And
so I would say, you know, it's always strange because I have friends who teach in stats, friends who teach in psychology, and I'll say something like, oh, you know, I was talking to some students today and one of their boyfriends, you know, bought them, you know, blah, 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 or something. Like, how do you know that? And I was like, because that's what we talk about in class. Like, because of the nature of writing, that students do share a lot with me, or with, you know, creative writing professors because it's kind of the nature of the course.
Yeah.
But I hear things about students, what they're struggling with, much more so than you would like in a lecture class. So I think like sharing those student stories really did. I mean, I was like, I can write about a 19-year-old because I work with them every day.
Yeah, right.
People do ask me like, oh, isn't it like, you know, at Carnegie Mellon, the students must get younger every year. And I was like, no. The students are always the same age.
Yeah.
They are always 19 to 22.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they don't change.
Yeah. You have that age group locked down. Yeah. You know them.
For all these years, they've always been the same.
Yeah.
So to see, like, Javi come back. I mean, I think of Javi still as a 20-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You know, Jen Bannon is one of my friends. I still think of her as a 20-year-old kid. You know, yeah. I remember them as that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. I know they're everyone's grown and adults now, but they were still, you know, 20 years old. So I do use a lot of their stories because people tell me things.
Yeah.
And I read their writing.
Yeah.
So I know what they're struggling with and what they're reflecting on.
When we meet up in like 20 years, don't think about whatever writing I gave you.
Why? You should be proud of it.
Yeah,
to like, think what you did at 19. Oh, I think if like I took poetry in college, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd just die if I ever read that.
No, not like a pleasure. So I don't know. And I really feel like not to like gas like English, even though I'm always trying to gas English, but I mean like I feel like we are put at such an advantage with like that sort of bond with professors and like talking and like being real about like your day.
Oh, yeah.
And like not overly, you know, like it doesn't have to be as serious as people make it out to be. Sharing your day-to-day things is just a part of like being a human being. And I feel like, especially at Carnegie Mellon, where we have the luxury of not being in a class of 250 people every day, to connect with that with professors and the people who we look up to. Whereas like, I don't hear that from other departments.
Well, I think it's also hard. Like if you're working on a story, you're working on a screenplay and it's about a young girl who's lost her mother. Like the conversation will be different than if we're talking about a math problem.
Yeah.
I mean, right away we're like, you know, talking about grief and talking about loss. So there's already a bond and a trust that has to be there so that I can comment on her work.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is the same thing like if we were talking about a psych problem.
Right.
I don't think. I don't, you know.
No,
I don't mean to assume, but I would think because there's such a, you know, you're working on personal relationships and interpersonal communication. So of course it will reflect in the people who are having it.
Right. I feel like it's pretty safe to assume that you're getting a better idea of the human being you're talking to, but when you're talking about a screenplay of something serious than working on material science. like I'm not to like
not to
do that like on not the podcast. Yeah. But like I do think that like that is
But and I can also totally, so sorry.
No.
I can also totally see the interpersonal relationships throughout To Be Marquette in that kind of like professors and students with each other, just like knowing each other on a crazy level that you just kind of get used to when you go to college.
Right.
Definitely.
But I love that. It was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Shay.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
So I guess just like a little question for fun.
For
what is a book that you hate? What is a book that you just like absolutely cannot stand?
You can't do it.
You think of it and you're like, bleh, awful. Never want to look at it again.
Yeah, I can't even think. Give me a hint.
How about like...
classic.
Yeah, like an author that you're
no
like...
No authors are going to be offended. Like, go back into
most
it.
I cannot read Middlemarch. I have started that. I have tried. I tried it during COVID. I tried it during a summer. I just get like 4 pages in and go, I hate it. So I don't want to be like Middlemarch. I don't get it.
Yeah,
completely.
I had a friend who really liked that book, and
I read Proust during COVID, but Middlemarch, I just go like I don't know. Page 4. I don't think I've gotten beyond 4.
But that's so fair.
Maybe this summer.
Yeah. Okay, we'll make it a goal.
How about you? What's a book you hate?
I cannot get myself to read, and I use this. Dylan knows it. I used this as my rating last time. I cannot read The Great Gatsby. I can't
do it.
Even though it's short?
Even though it's short, I read it and I'm just like, ugh. I can't get past it.
I mean, that shows that maybe it's out of cultural context or something.
No, say it isn't so.
Okay,
I love The Great Gatsby.
Okay, what book do you hate?
Yeah. Oh, I feel like I've I bitch so much about some books sometimes. I don't know. What's a book I hate?
The Stranger.
The Stranger.
Oh, I did not enjoy The Stranger. Yeah. I would much rather read The Fall. But I gotta tell you, I also read Notes from Underground, and I had my head in my hands by the end. And I've read other Dostoevsky stuff. Like, I read The Brothers Karamazov, and, like, that was okay. I mean,
but when, like, you say your head in your hands, is that good or bad?
Bad.
Oh,
bad. I just was like,
I thought you were sobbing.
You know, sometimes they just don't know how to write a lady without making them, like, a prostitute. So it's just, like,
it's
sometimes
right. I'm just that's sort what of we're doing now.
Hard to get through. Yeah. But on that note,
if you want to be a guest on the podcast, follow our Instagram at CMU Booked. You can DM us, reach out to any of us personally, find me on campus, DM me, do it.
Email us, text us if you got our digits.
Do it.
Yeah. And so, Sharon, your favorite CMU dining location?
The Zebra Cafe.
The Zebra Cafe. Boom. Ooh, she's fancy. How about you?
Exchange.
Exchange?
Hannah.
Me?
Yes.
Hunan.
That's crazy.
Yup.
Dylan.
She said it. Dylan, give it to us. The manager.
Defer.
English girl.
Beautiful. All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Yes. Kisses, and we'll see you guys next week. Get excited.
Bye.